Well, I guess let's start with where we are today. Walk me through the process and the decision to go to referendum, both the operating one and your construction.
Sure, yeah, I'll start back in 2020 when we chose to go to referendum in April of 2020. In November of 2020, we chose to do a 1.25 recurring operational budget. And at that time, we looked at a capital improvement project that consisted just short of $30 million. And we told the public at that point that we were still in the midst of, right in the middle of a declining enrollment that we anticipated would continue to last for anywhere from 6 to 10 years. And did a study with UW Populations Lab out of Madison, and that's what they showed as well. And so we knew that that was going to be a Band-Aid that was going to get us out there, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 years. And the operational referendum passed. The capital referendum failed narrowly in November of 2020. We went back for a revised version of that capital referendum in April of 2021. That failed quite substantially, okay? And as a result, we went from a 5-building footprint down to a 3-building footprint. We brought our 7th and 8th graders up to the high school, and we closed and subsequently sold two of our elementary buildings, and we're now in a 3-building model. Fast forward now 4 years, we continue to have some of the deferred maintenance issues that we had back in 2020. We're in a smaller footprint, so it's been a little bit easier to manage. We don't have as many roofs to deal with, as many parking lots to deal with, et cetera, but we still have issues. Our community, you know, feels that our quote-unquote new high school, which was built in 1996, is new, but it's pushing 30 years old, and many of the original materials, roofing, parking lots, things like that, just have not lasted through the course of 3 decades. So we did a facility study, hired Nexus Solutions out of northern Wisconsin and Minnesota to do a facility study last year. And they came back and they said, there's a lot of things that you could fix, but here are some things that you really need to explore fixing. And that price tag was, you know, pushing $80 million of things that really could have been addressed. And so with that, we said, we have to get the community's involvement in this. We have to understand what their priorities are. We are a public school, and therefore we have to listen to the public and the stakeholders of the public. So in December of 2023, we hired the Morris Leatherman Company to do a public survey. And they do it the old-fashioned way. They call people up, and they make sure that they hit all of the different demographics within our district and get good feedback from them on terms of what their priorities are. And they essentially found, and when they reported the survey results, they found that the community supported, and when I say supported, at least 55% of the people that they polled supported 9 different things. They supported everything from number 1 being safety and security, to number 2 ADA accessibility, technical education upgrades in our classrooms here at the high school, air conditioning at our primary and our intermediate school. Our high school has air conditioning, but the other 2 buildings do not. We have energy efficiency and envelope, windows, doors, etc., that need to be addressed. Deferred maintenance, again, our roof on the high school is 30 years old, at least portions of it are. We've been able to replace some of that through budget money and things like that over the last couple of years. Hard surface areas, parent drop-off, bus drop-off, pick-up, things like that. In addition to high school auditorium upgrades, sound and light equipment in the auditorium, again, is 30 years old. Those are the top 7, and then number 8 was athletic turf onto our athletic fields, and number 9 was a new gymnasium and or fitness center. And so the community supported those 9 things with 55% or more supporting that. However, when it came down to the financial impact, what could they actually afford from a property tax increase on their financial bill, their financial impact wouldn't support all 9 of those priorities. And so we found the number that they could support. We found that the average homeowner could support a $15 a month increase, and that would get us the top 7 priorities. So it would not get us the athletic turf, and it would not get us a new field house or fitness center. Okay, and I think our board was comfortable with that. I know I was administratively, because the first seven things truly were needs, and you get down to number 8 and 9, and they felt a little bit more like a want, right? Like we would like athletic turf, we would like a new gym or a fitness center, but we really didn't have to have those. And so it kind of felt like it was a natural break to address those top seven. And so that's kind of where we're at from a capital standpoint. This will be a $27 million, just north of $27 million capital to address those top seven issues. In addition to that, we are still facing declining enrollment. Our freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors all have residents in those age groups that are over 100 students. And then from our eighth grade and below, they're all like in the 80s. Okay, so there's a real cliff there between our eighth and ninth grade class. And so we know that we have four more years of declining enrollment that we've got to get through. And so the thought process there was, let's do a four-year non-recurring operational referendum, get us through the 4 years of declining enrollment, and then really be able to reassess where we're at in 4 years. And so that's kind of how we've got to where we are today. And so those will be the two questions on the ballot in April.
So when it comes to making sure the public understands what they're saying yes to, how do you have to sell it to them in this environment to make sure that they understand that this is outside of what the state does, or this is outside of what a different district did, or this, you know, these are things that if we don't do this, this won't happen, or these are the consequences?
Yeah, I never think that it's our job to sell a referendum to the public. I think our job as administrators and our school board is to simply inform the public, right? And to make sure that they understand what they're getting if they vote yes. And I think it's equally important to make sure that they understand what they're going to be losing or sacrificing if they vote no. And so one of the things that we did post-pandemic was we added some instructional learning positions through the ESSER dollars. Our board had approved 14 FTE over the course to be able to be used over the course of 2 years. Our original goal was that we would have 10 the first year to really help address the learning losses due to the pandemic, and then we would scale that down to four the next year. We weren't able to fill all 10 of those positions, and so we ended up with 8.5 the first year and 5.5 the next year, and that next year being 23-24. And so one of the things that will happen if that operational referendum fails is that we'll be forced to eliminate those 5.5 positions. We will not be able to sustain them. And while that was funded with ESSER dollars and that stimulus money through the pandemic, we're finding that we're not completely out of the pandemic when it comes to addressing learning losses. Students are coming in lower than where they should be from a grade level standpoint, and we've got to make sure that we have enough supports to get them caught back up. And so that's a real issue, not just in the Richland School District, but from our neighboring districts. Certainly the folks I've talked to in education, this is going on everywhere. And so if we don't pass the operational referendum, that'll be one of the first things that needs to happen, is that we will eliminate those 5.5 FTE positions that we've added. In addition, part of that operational referendum is going to be to try to get our staff, our teachers, our support staff, our aides, our food service, everybody in our district to competitive wages. Because one of the things that we've found is that over the course of trying to be very fiscally responsible over the last several decades, we have not increased our wages to a point to keep up with neighboring districts. And so it's very common for us to have teachers reach 55, reach retirement age, at least retirement eligible from a local benefit standpoint, retire from the Richland School District at 55, 56, 57, collect the local retirement benefit, only to go to a neighboring district and continue teaching. And that was disheartening to me that we were losing veteran, experienced teachers, people who have been a staple in our community and in our school district for so many years, that we were losing them in the last few years of their teaching experience to neighboring districts simply because of pay. We often lose teachers or don't get teachers that are interviewing that we're offering positions to because a neighboring district, and when I say neighboring, I'm not just talking adjoining to us, but you know, within a 30-40 mile radius, we're losing them to those districts simply because they pay more. And I've always felt we didn't need to be the top paying school district around, but we can't be the lowest, and we've got to be somewhere above the middle, right? And I believe that having a good culture and a good community and a good experience and having good coworkers and all of those things really do play a part in a good work experience. But we do have to be financially competitive, and so this referendum would help get us to be financially competitive as well.
So on your sheet, you listed it as a $0 tax increase. So explain how that works. Because if some people get confused, well, how can it cost $0? But
yeah, absolutely. That's a great question, one that we often field. So when we passed the referendum in 2020, the first year that went on the tax burden, it was just that. It went up, and it went up to $9.12 per thousand to our tax rate or mill rate. The next year, the school district, because we're positively aided, we got aided on that money from the state. And so if everything were just left to just natural reduction, our property taxes in our community would have actually went down in years 2 and 3 because we would have gotten aided on those expenditures. Our school board decided to not put us in a position where our mill rate or our tax rate was unhealthy low, which it was prior to the passage of the 2020 referendum. We were down into the fives at one point. And so we wanted to stabilize that mill rate and then use that to prepay some of our existing debt. We had a 2016 referendum that was passed, and our debt payment was structured so that we didn't make a single penny of principal payment until 2026. We were making all interest payments. And so by using what's known as defeasance, we kept the tax rate at $9.12 and then used that additional revenue to prepay some principal on that 2016 debt. As a result, we've taken an $8.7 million debt, and we've got it down to just over $4 million in just a couple of years. And so then we've been able to use that gap to do this operational referendum essentially at a zero tax impact. If it fails, we would stabilize the mill rate, keep it at $9.12, and continue to pay off that debt. And if it passes, we would stop the defeasance and apply it towards this debt.
So when you talk about the defeasance, then would you go back to paying interest only until 2026?
That is correct, yes. Yeah, we would go back, we'd restructure that debt, work with Baird, our financial advisors, to restructure that if needed. And again, as we saw, or if we see the mill rate drop, my guess would be, I can't speak for what future boards would do, and my recommendation would be that we allow it to drop to account for inflationary rates so that people don't see a tax increase on their property tax bill. But if we can find a way that their net tax stays the same, I could foresee a situation where the school district would continue to use defeasance in some fashion, but not nearly to the extreme that we have been using it.
Mm-hmm. And that's an accounting methodology that's allowed under the revenue caps and state law that I know that's been talked about trying to eliminate that.
Correct, yes. I don't know where they're at legislatively regarding that, but it is allowed under the revenue limit to assess additional levy to prepay what's known as Fund 39 debt or debt that is referendum approved. And so a district can only do that if they have referendum debt out there for capital improvements that they're taking out bonds on, and then they can use that defeasance strategy as a way to help stabilize the mill rate. Oftentimes you'll see districts go to referendum when they have debt falling off, and so they'll strategically plan for a referendum when they know they have a loan coming off the books where the property tax or the mill rate would have naturally dropped, and then they'll use that to fill in the gap so that it's not such a huge impact. So I believe, again, this is my personal and professional opinion, that I believe we've been fiscally responsible in stabilizing the mill rate and prepaying debt. I believe that we were kind of in a situation prior to that where we had a lot of credit card debt out there, and we were simply making the minimum payments. And yes, it doesn't hurt our credit limit by doing that, but are we really being fiscally responsible paying all of this additional interest when we could be attacking it a little bit more aggressively? So that was the approach that we took.
So could you see a circumstance in future years where question two debt is actually handled the same way?
I could see that, where instead of stretching that out over 20 years, that we could maybe pay that off in a little less, especially if more equalization aid comes in from the state and we're able to, again, we don't want to raise taxes, and ideally, if both of these questions passed, we will go from $9.12 up to $10.22. That's getting to the edge of where it's probably higher than we would like it. So I would envision, you know, if I could look into a crystal ball and see what's going to happen, if over the next 5 or 6 years, if that were just naturally to drop back into the $9 range, I would foresee our boards considering allowing that to drop, but probably not allowing it to drop more than the $9.12 or $9 mark. I don't see us getting back into the 7 or 8s like we were before. But again, that's a hypothetical, and I don't know the answer to that for sure.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the 2021 budget session.
Sure.
I know, I'm sure it rolls off the tongue around. But in that particular budget, as you probably remember from a school's perspective, there was a controversy among whether Republicans in the legislature would add on to the per pupil revenue limit, and they decided to do $0 for 2 years because they said all these schools are so flush with all the federal cash coming in, we don't need to give them any more money. They can use that money at the time. And the same debate, there were Democrats and there were public school advocates that were saying this will cripple schools, this will create a fiscal cliff, this will cause huge problems down the road, and the state just sat on the money. At the time, you were not superintendent, but you were in the business office here, is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Okay, so what was your perspective as you were hearing that debate playing out?
Yeah, everything that you just said is exactly true. I mean, we knew we were getting these ESSER funding positions or this funding mechanism, and we knew that there wasn't going to be a per pupil increase. And I think, there were so much flexibility in how you could spend ESSER dollars. And I think the key thing with the ESSER dollars was that unlike other federal funding dollars like title money and some of those things, you could truly supplant funds. And so you could take funds that you were paying for out of Fund 10 dollars, general budget dollars, and you could supplant that with the ESSER dollars. And so that gave schools some flexibility in how they spent it, but it really didn't fix the problem. It really didn't give school districts any kind of a sustainable way to manage these. And so you talk about simply in our district where we funded extra positions. We had to hire these positions knowing that there was going to be an end to those. And so again, that made it difficult to attract good quality people because it could have been a one-year position, and at the most it could have been a two-year position. And that's where we're at. We're going to lose good quality people. Now we've got to do it through a referendum to offset that additional revenue. But that was the problem that I saw back then, and I think every school district saw that, and many of them rolled the dice and said that, okay, we're going to just deal with it when it down the road, and we're going to hire additional people. Others took the approach that, nope, this is one-time money. Let's do one-time things with it. Perhaps it was capital improvements. You saw a lot of school districts, I think, address the air quality with air conditioning and other HVAC upgrades. And again, that's all fine and dandy. Those weren't necessarily sustainable expenses that they have. We tried to invest back into our students, and in doing so, we were rolling the dice a little bit because we didn't know if those positions would continue, and obviously they wouldn't without the support of a referendum.
So at that time, was it alarmist to say this will create a fiscal cliff and create disparities, or was it simply being able to see the trajectory of knowing what was going to happen?
Yeah, it was definitely concerning for us. The one thing that we had going for us as a Richland School District, we had just passed, as I mentioned earlier, passed the 2020 referendum, and we had been very clear to the public that this is a Band-Aid. This is something we are going to have to go back. So what the ESSER funding cliff or fiscal cliff did was, instead of potentially getting us out 6 years, like maybe we had hoped from being real optimist, it did only get us out 4 years. And so we would be operating at a deficit of over $1 million next year if we don't pass the referendum and make the cuts that we need to make. And so we knew that this was happening. We also knew that we had already told the public that we would be lined up to go to referendum. And so I think in the back of our minds, we had always known that this was probably going to happen in 2024 when the ESSER dollars were expended.
From a federal perspective, when those different different bills were passed that became ESSERs 1, 2, and 3, or that included those, there was the perspective that was supposed to be to help kids recover from the pandemic, to catch up academically, to help schools accommodate to a new environment. So do you think the way that some of the monies were spent to backfill a budget hole fell in line with the philosophy of what that money was intended for? Did it actually help students recover?
Yeah, I think that varies a little bit by district. Okay, if I remember correctly, I believe that there were four different sources that made up ESSER funding. The first one, known as ESSER I, was the CARES Act, and that was a small, relatively speaking, a small influx of money that was given right away to school districts to help address PPE and equipment. And in our standpoint, that was really what that was spent on, right? The other was the gear money, which was primarily spent towards technology and helping students and teachers be able to work in a remote and a virtual setting. We were already a one-to-one device school for the most part, so we were able to still upgrade some technology and provide a lot of hotspots, those kinds of things, to our families. But I believe with 100% certainty that those first two rounds of money, albeit not that high of a percentage in the total ESSER pot, were dedicated specifically to what the federal government wanted them and intended for them to be used for. ESSER 2 and 3, which came about in the subsequent year after the pandemic, that was the larger chunk of money that schools had until, I believe, September 30th, 2024, that they have to spend it. We've claimed all of ours. Many school districts, I believe, have, although I don't know that with 100% certainty. But I believe that allowed them to really address it in one of those two ways that we talked about. We chose to reinvest it back into education, get students back in the building, get them in front of teachers. If we have to hire more staff to have fewer students in a classroom, those kinds of things, we wanted to do that as opposed to these one-time capital expenditures like HVAC or air conditioning, which will be around for 20 years, right? But we really wanted to try to focus on addressing the learning loss, and so that's where we put it in. What other school districts did, I think you could ask 412 school districts and you'd probably get 412 different variations of how they spent that ESSER money.
So if I told you that since the start of the COVID pandemic that half of all school districts in Wisconsin have gone to operating referenda, would you say that is accurate? Or would you say that's not surprising? Or are you surprised? Would that be low?
Yeah, I believe that our research has shown that since 2020 that over two-thirds of the school districts in Wisconsin have gone to some sort of a referendum. Now, so half of them being operational, that would not surprise me at all. I believe that there are 83 going to referendum in April, and I anticipate that number to be higher in November. Traditionally speaking, school districts have chosen to go to a general election in November for these sorts of things. So I just anticipate that number being even higher, and it's a real thing. I mean, school districts are losing a substantial amount of revenue due to the ESSER funding cliff, coupled with the lack of state influx in per pupil spending. And in the last biennial budget, they added the additional $325 per pupil. But that was a little misleading because what happened in many school districts' case, certainly on the western side of the state in rural areas, was they gave you the $325 per pupil, but it wasn't net new income because the first thing that had to happen was they took away the hold harmless exemption that schools had been getting, right? And so in the case of the Richland School District for the 23-24 budget, when we first heard we were getting $325 per student, we anticipated that being, over $400,000 of new revenue. But they took away, $340,000 in a hold harmless exemption. So what we ended up netting was about $72 per pupil out of that $325. And so it was a little misleading in terms of the new money that we were able to get. So when you couple those two things together, it doesn't surprise me at all that many, many school districts are going to have to go to referendum just to maintain the services that they've been providing for our students, in addition to wage increases as it comes to, even if they were a competitive school district from a salary and wage standpoint, just keeping up with inflation. Transportation costs have increased dramatically. All utility costs have increased dramatically. So expenses are going up, revenue is going down. That's not a formula for success.
Yeah, when you add in 21, 22, 23, 0, 0, and then in your case, an effective $72,
I believe, for the 23-24 school year.
And then when you factor that against inflation and everything else, I mean, that's you've had a significant decline in revenue against for real dollars.
Absolutely, you know, and the $80,000 or so of what truly ended up to be net new money for the 23-24 certainly welcomed, but nowhere near what it would take for us to sustain the programming that we had prior. You know, we budget $85,000 for a teacher, one teacher position on average for their salary and their fringe benefits. So the $80,000 of additional money didn't even truly fund one teacher. And that's a little disheartening, knowing that we were all anticipating a little bit more money.
Mm-hmm. So when I look at the Fiscal Bureau's print-off of what Richland received over the course of the four allocations, if you're counting gear, the total number they've got here is a little over $5 million.
That sounds accurate.
Okay. Yep. And then last, I know the lion's share of that $3 million was ESSER III, which is
correct.
Part of what you guys were talking about at your school board last meeting.
Correct.
So have you basically been living off that for the past few years when you factor that against the $0 that the state has been giving in additional per pupil revenue?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think it's also accurate to say we did add some of those new positions to really try to help mitigate the learning loss. And so had we been in the same structure that we were in 2020, 2021, we would not have had to, if you just take the pandemic out, but gave us this additional money that you could spend over 3 years, we probably could have stretched that out a little longer because we didn't have to. We wouldn't have had to add additional teachers and supports into the classroom. But again, due to the pandemic, we had to do that. And so living off of it, because we would have been operating under a deficit anyway, and adding those extra positions just exacerbated the problem.
So when you think of the politics that go into the decisions surrounding this, because it's all politics. I mean, no matter how much you want to be insulated from that debate, it's federal politics and it's state politics. What do you say to a community when you're saying, basically, I need your vote to bail out decisions made elsewhere?
Yeah, we've tried to be very clear to our public. We had a community forum down at our local bowling alley in their banquet hall a couple weeks ago, and one of the things that I was presenting was why we need this operational referendum, because we do have this declining enrollment, which means less revenue to our district, which is an entirely different topic on, you know, an antiquated formula from 1993 on how the revenue limit is set. Just a slight comment on that. You know, I think it's ludicrous for the state to think that just because a school district loses 15 students, you know, in a pre-K through grade 12 scenario covering 15 grades, if they lose 15 students, that's a revenue loss of, you know, $170,000. But if you average those 15 students out over 15 grades, that's one student per grade. That doesn't allow you to make any substantial changes or cuts to your educational programming. You can't eliminate staffing. You can't eliminate the internet. You can't eliminate any real expenses, but yet you're forced to do it with less dollars. And so that whole system of how schools are funded is broken, in my opinion, and needs to be reexamined. But with that, you know, we had to communicate that to our public. We had to say, look, this is the reality of the demographics of the residents in the Richland School District. Again, we had a more recent population study done by UW-Madison Applied Population Lab showing that the residents, school-aged children, age 4 to 18, that live and reside in the Richland School District is declining. And it's going to continue to decline for the next few years. And so when we can see that our higher classes in terms of enrollment are in the, you know, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, most people can understand pretty easily that in 4 years they're not going to be part of our school district anymore, and we're going to be left with fewer students. And if we have fewer students, then we're going to have fewer revenue or less revenue. And so we've got to explain this to the community that we are simply not getting the funding that we need to be able to offer the programming that our stakeholders expect and our students deserve.
You're represented here in the Assembly by a Republican who's on Joint Finance Committee, and in the Senate, this is Howard Markline's district.
That's correct.
By a Republican on the Joint Finance Committee. So the most important budget writing committee, the most power there. Is there a delicate nature of how you approach a public that is likely voting for the very people that are making the decisions that end up shortchanging the school, so that you're forced to go back to them to say, hey, I know you probably voted for that guy, but it's their decisions that put us in this situation?
Yeah, I've tried to just be very factual and transparent with people that I talk to. So when I'm out in the public explaining the why of why we need a referendum, I try to really avoid personal opinion and just keep to the facts. This is why, this is how we got here, this is what will happen if we don't. On the other end, I also try to have conversations with Tony Kurtz and Howard Markline in terms of this is the reality of where school districts are at, so that they understand. And I give both of them a lot of credit in terms of they're always willing to listen, and I know that they get around in our area a lot and are probably hearing similar things. I hope that they're trying to make positive change for school finance, you know, in the future. But I really try to keep those two conversations separate.
Is that just something that you have personally chosen to do, or is it just not smart for the schools to wade into that territory? I mean, the current climate between schools and politics is not healthy.
Yeah, it's not healthy. I think it's a little cleaner. You know, when we're doing a referendum, you know, campaign, informational campaign about a referendum, the laws are pretty clear on a school district cannot be, and certainly someone in my position or our school board's position cannot be pro-referendum or anti-referendum. It's our job to simply provide the facts and then inform the public and provide as many opportunities as we can to get that information to the public to allow them to make an informed decision. So I just really hesitate in blurring any of those lines that could possibly jeopardize where we're at in the future.
You mentioned something before about the choice of which election date to go to. And that's interesting because obviously November does get higher turnout. It should be quite large, presidential election year, but that's into the next school year already. The budgets are already set versus going in April. Was that the timing of April and certainty for next year's budget more of a factor than which election might have higher turnout?
Yeah, I think it was twofold, really. There were two specific reasons, and we strongly considered going in November because it does get a higher turnout. Every statistic will show that it gets a higher turnout, and when you get a higher turnout, you're representing more of your stakeholders, and so you truly get a little bit better representation of what your stakeholders want for your public school. The problem with going in November was twofold in our opinion. One was the fact that it is already, the budgets are set for the 24-25, and so the school board would have had to be willing to operate a year in out of fund balance and out of our reserves, or make those cuts, you know, for the 24-25 and then have to rehire, you know, if the referendum would be successful. So that was certainly a component. We will now know as we are planning for the 24-25 school year, what our situation is after April 2nd. The other was that what I think school districts saw in 2020 was a highly contentious presidential election. And unlike previous general elections in November, that one seemed to have a different flavor to it. And I think many people suspect 2024 being similarly contentious and perhaps drawing people who really aren't concerned about schools and school finance and the residents of the pupils of the school district, but more because they have a horse in the presidential race. And so I think when we coupled those two things together, yes, we're going to get better turnout in November, but one, we won't know what our future holds until after November, and the volatility that surrounds a highly contentious presidential election, I think that our board, and I think many school districts, is evident by, you know, the 80 plus that are going to referendum in April, felt that April was just a better choice.
I mean, it's known that there's a lower info voter that shows up in November. They are less likely to vote in more elections, they are less informed about elections, but they do show up for presidential elections, and they are usually more easily motivated by negative animus surrounding a campaign, which doesn't, yeah, fall hand in glove with what you're trying to achieve.
Correct. And while an April election may not get as high of a turnout, it should still show statistically with statistical relevance, you know, the representation of our stakeholders. So we're hoping that shows.
Well, and this April is interesting in that it is a presidential primary, even though the Democratic side is not really contested at all, and the Republican side is questionable as to whether you could call it contested.
Correct.
It doesn't have the same flair of the last April Supreme Court election or in prior presidential primaries, but it should be higher. So do you, when it comes to turnout, and this is probably not your area of expertise, but it's one of my little things that I look at, I mean, how does that factor in? Because it's not November, but it's not a normal April with no Supreme Court or no statewide, but it is not a normal presidential primary. Do you have any expectation of what that means, of who it might draw in?
I don't, yeah. I think in a perfect world, I think that we would have been able to be financially relevant and sustainable through November 2026. That would have been when we went in 2020 and we're thinking, best case scenario, we can get out 6 years. That would be, the best case scenario for us. Coupled with all of the things that we've already discussed and the lack of true new dollars in the state budget, zero in 2021, a net 72 for us in 2023, the ESSER money falling off, couple all that in, we simply can't make it that long, right? And so then we're forced to choose when is the best time to go. And we can only ask two questions in a calendar year. We're choosing to do both of them in April, hoping that we'll get a good turnout. There's some local races. There still are some national races from the primary, albeit many of them may be determined at that point. But we're hoping that we get a good turnout, good representation of what our stakeholders want, and then we can make a plan moving forward.
All right. I do want to ask just a couple quick questions about the info sheet that was handed out last night about the ESSER funds.
Sure.
One of the things on there, one of the largest things on there, was the roof. And according to this, it looks like it was somewhere south of $500,000.
It was actually total, if you look at the 22-23 and the 23-24, it was just under $800,000.
Okay.
And so we were able to, I believe it's the second bar graph on that that chart, shows that we spent all of what we budgeted for last year. I obviously knew what that dollar amount was, so that's why it would match up. But if you add those two up together, it would be about $800,000 for...
So just because it hadn't been expended yet...
Correct. Well, that'll be done this spring, and then we'll be paying for that out of this year's budget before June 30th.
Okay. So, I mean, when you talk about the positions added, there were some one-time expenses that you used the ESSER.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. We also, back in 2021, decided to give all of our hourly employees, again, kind of competitive wages. We did a local wage study and realized that many of our people can go work at it. You know, our local Culver's or Walmart and make more money than they were making for a school district. So we did use some of the ESSER dollars and commit to it for 3 years and give everybody a $3 per hour raise that was on an hourly wage. So that is also trying to be addressed with this operational referendum, because that will be difficult to sustain if we don't have the additional revenue.
So one of the, this is gets into the political art area again, so apologize if you're not comfortable answering this, but one of the arguments that I hear at the Capitol is that, you know, public schools don't always deserve a higher level of reinvestment because, you know, they're underwhelming and kids are failing and not doing as well, and, you know, sometimes those statements are made about those people or they or them, and not necessarily our people or, you know, those in our backyard. But there is a thought that, you know, schools are failing and they're failing kids and kids aren't reading, and, you know, there's more kids coming in with problems out of the COVID pandemic. But then when you look at the fact that money that was specifically given to schools to handle those, schools were forced to then backfill a budget that was directly left empty, and then the state sat on billions of dollars in its general coffers for years on end. How do you feel when you start adding that whole cloud of thought together, where they're trying to pin a blame on somewhere, there's a political justification when there's a big pot of money over here and they made you spend different money that would have been used for that?
Yep. Yeah, I believe that if you want to prioritize something, you have to allocate the right resources to it. And resource means people, money, and time, right? And you have to do all three of them in order to have any substantial change. And so, you know, if people are saying that school districts are failing, I mean, that may not necessarily be false, okay, in terms of Wisconsin's achievement scores or even the Richland School District's achievement scores, comparatively speaking, all right? But if school districts don't have the proper resources to truly make an impact on student learning, I mean, we've had science books that were that we were using for several years that were written prior to the mapping of DNA, right? I mean, they were truly done from the 80s, right? And so textbooks and curriculum, because of the lack of funding over the last few decades, hasn't been able to keep up, and they've been forced to do so much teaching through being resourceful. And when you start, and it's great to be resourceful, right? But when teachers are forced to continually be resourceful, it's easy to get away from the standards, and it's easy to get away from the things that we have to be teaching. Couple that with a lack of true investment into people wanting to go into the education and the profession. And I mean, we've hired many, many teachers that have bachelor's degree, but don't necessarily have the teacher preparation program and have gone through that extensive program, which helps prepare them. But it's kind of a hybrid. We're getting backfilled and getting licensures and helping them get that licensure taken care of. But we don't have the best people that are in math going into the teaching profession. We don't have the best scientists going into the teaching profession because they can make more money elsewhere. And I'm not saying that teaching needs to be, you know, the same as working in the private industry, but the disparity continues to grow. And so you look at, you know, teachers going into the field, the funding that goes into the field, and, you know, none of it aligns with being highly successful from an achievement standpoint. It just doesn't. And so I think, you know, at the state level, at the federal level, if we really want to reinvest back into education, invest into our people, we've got to do it with all three of those, with people, with time, and with the financial resources. We have to develop a better infrastructure. We have to have ways to address the mental health needs of students in the classrooms. We have, especially again in the western part of the state and in our area, we have the demographic makeup. We have so many single family parents raising children. We have so many students that struggle with mental health and anxiety, and we don't address any of those needs, and yet public schools are forced to do more and more parenting, are being asked to be professionals when it comes to health standards, when it comes to mental health standards. We're not trained for those things, and we have to be able to provide the resources to get these students the help and supports that they need so that we can truly focus on achievement. But if they don't have the foundational needs met, if they don't have a roof to sleep under, if they don't have food on the table, if they don't get a good night's rest, if they don't have those fundamentals in their lives, then how do you expect them to learn in school, right? And so I think this is a systematic change that has to take place, as a society, and we've got to start reinvesting in our future.
All right. Anything else you want to add?
I probably spoke enough today.
quickly before I go, can I get you to give me a little bit of your bio history? How long you've been with the district, different job titles?
Yeah, I started off coaching girls basketball in Richland Center back in 1994. I was a private business owner through 2012, decided to go back to school and get my bachelor's because I could see that there was I had an ability to influence students in a positive way through the coaching world. So I got my teaching degree, did it mostly online, started teaching in 2014, moved into an administrative role in 2017, an assistant principal here at the high school, then became the business official shortly after that, and then last year took on the interim superintendent role, and then this year the superintendent role. So that's a brief synopsis of my life.
All right, please say and spell your name, just so I have it correct.
Yep, it's Steve Board, B as in boy, O-A-R, D as in dog.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
You survived. Do you want a room tone? All right, so if we can just be quiet for like 30 seconds, he's going to capture the sound of the room, which sounds weird, but it's a thing.